Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
This podcast was recorded Wednesday, May 6th at 10:31 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like they did on VJ Day and VE Day at the end of World War II, generations of Americans will celebrate May 4th as VI Day, Victory in Iran, the day the Iran War ended, the day President Trump declared the military operation was terminated in a letter to Congress, just as the deadline to get congressional approval hit. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who use legal maneuvers to avoid having to meet the Constitution's requirement that only Congress can declare war. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up on the podcast, the political drama in Delaware County comes to an end. But first, the candidates are set for Ohio's general election in November. There were no big surprises in this week's primary. Sherrod Brown easily beat his Democratic primary opponent and will face U.S. Senator John Husted in November. In the governor's race, Democrat Amy Acton was unopposed, and Vivek Ramaswamy easily beat his Republican challenger, Casey Putsch. Ramaswamy says Republicans are unified to take on Acton, who he calls a socialist.
I do believe that this marks, without exception, the single most consequential election for governor that our state has ever seen in our history. There has never been a greater contrast between two candidates.
Let the hyperbole begin. You know, every election is the most consequential in our history. Until the next one. Anyway, you know, there is a pretty big contrast between the tech billionaire and the former Ohio director of public health. We'll get to that. It'll be interesting to watch. In other races decided in Tuesday's primary, the favorites in the Secretary of State primaries won. Current State Treasurer Robert Sprague, the Republican, will face former House Democratic leader Allison Russo. In the interesting Republican primary for State Treasurer, J.D. Vance-backed Jay Edwards beat Ramaswamy-backed Christina Rogner by a fairly comfortable margin. And in a closely watched Republican primary in Northwest Ohio, former State Rep. Derek Merrin won the chance for a rematch with Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur of Toledo. To help us break down the races, especially that congressional contest in the 9th District in Northwest Ohio, we welcome back to Snollygoster, University of Toledo political science professor Sam Nelson. Sam, welcome back to Snollygoster.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the last time you were on was in 2024, and we were fondly reminiscing about the landscaping skills of J.R. Majewski, the candidate for Congress in 22, who famously, painted a Trump sign in his lawn? Is that what it was?
I think he mowed it into the lawn so you can see it from the air.
Yeah, see, mowing it into the lawn, that's a lot of work because you got to keep mowing it, as we know, in the springtime. Anyway, well, thanks very much for getting back to us. We will get to the 9th District race in a moment, but we want to touch on the bigger races, the governor's race. Ramaswamy says the Republican Party is united. He crushed his opponent, Casey Putsch, 83% to 17%. But Casey Putsch did get 143,000 votes. He ran, let's put this politely, as politely as we can, he ran as a Christian conservative alternative to Ramaswamy's South Asian American heritage and Hindu religion. Does Ramaswamy see those votes in that 17% that Putsch got as a concern heading into November?
I think he really needs to see them as a concern. There's a BGSU poll that shows about half of Putsch voters don't want to vote for Ramaswamy in the general election. So Ramaswamy needs to figure out a way to either appeal to those voters or kind of paper over whatever it is that they oppose. But of course, as you pointed out, if his identity is the problem, there's not a whole lot he can do in a campaign to change their minds.
What do you think? He's a force on the stump. He really is a very dynamic speaker. But as you heard in that soundbite, it seems a bit forced. I mean, he seems to oversell the importance of this election. It's an important election, no doubt. And there's a contrast between him and Acton. But to say without a doubt it's the most consequential election in Ohio's history, I'm not sure people are buying that.
Republicans have had the governorship for 16 years. They've had all of state government for 16 years. How can you say, oh, you can't run as a change candidate when your party has controlled every aspect of the government for 16 years?
Yeah, it's interesting that he seems to be, this race is just starting. Really, we have 6 months to go. The primary is always sort of the kickoff point to the general. You know, he's been running ads prior to the primary, basically criticizing Acton for her role in shutting down the state government during the earliest days of COVID. Now he's calling her a socialist. Does he lean into that now and not so much, you know, shut down Amy, or does he do both?
I mean, I think he's going to do both. Obviously he's a billionaire. He can spend as much money as he wants on television in this race and pick the things. But, you know, he's got some vulnerabilities when it comes to COVID response, given the industry that he's in. And, you know, I don't know all the details, but there are questions that the Acton campaign is going to be able to raise. And they've, I think, held fire as long as the primaries were going on. But I'm sure they've got a thick opposition research file on the guy.
What do you think her primary message will be over the next 6 months? She's been talking a lot about this affordability. Her plan is complicated. You know, we talk about tax credits and things like that to help working families and low-income people. What will be her message? Will it be that affordability, or will it be more that, you know, a tech billionaire shouldn't run the state?
I think she'll do both, but I think affordability is likely to be her primary focus. Really, that's the primary focus of Democratic campaigns across the country. And campaigns, even for governor, are much more nationalized now than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And affordability is maybe the key national issue. The governor of Ohio can't do anything about the price of gas, but can certainly take advantage of people's anger at the price of gas.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that hurt, hurt the candidates in 24. It hurt Kamala Harris in Ohio and because of the economy and things like that. Moving to the U.S. Senate race, again, no surprise there. Sherrod Brown won 89% of the vote in the Democratic primary over his opponent, Ron Kincaid, who got 78,000 votes. You know, is there any sign of Democratic angst, disunity there, or is that a pretty standard primary margin?
I think that's pretty standard. You know, there's a lot of things that can go into somebody picking up 8%. There are people who are registered Democrats still vote in Democratic primaries, but are, you know, more independent or Republican leaning anyway, and they may not like Sherrod Brown and just, you know, cast a protest vote. But I don't see anything there that's probably a big concern to Brown. I haven't seen anybody saying, oh, you know, I won't vote for him if he gets the nomination.
Yeah, they're already up on ads, anti-Houston ads this morning. I saw on television the day after the primary linking John Houston to the Epstein files and President Trump's reluctance to release those at first. And he'll be linked to the Iran war and gas prices. So that race is really, money will not be an issue in that race either, I don't think. We're going to see a lot of TV ads.
Yeah, that's going to be a very expensive race. Lots of outside money will be coming in for both candidates. So I expect we'll just be inundated with TV. Now, what will be interesting to see is, you know, sort of what the strategy is. The Marino campaign ran an awful lot of anti-trans ads and things like that. And I don't know that works for Husted in 2026, the way it maybe worked for Marino in 2024.
Yeah, you know, looking at that Bowling Green State University poll, you mentioned the trans rights, social issues were not very high on voters' minds. Now, you still can target those in ads and raise the issue and raise the importance of it. But the economy was far and away, economy and inflation, far and away the top issues. I think that's where this race will be.
And Brown's in a perfect position to link Husted to Trump, because there's no distance between Husted and Trump. There's no distance between Trump and any of the Republicans in the House or Senate right now in terms of voting records and things like that. And Husted's only been there a year and a half. It's not like he's had any opportunity to distinguish himself as an independent voice in the Senate or have any real, you know, priorities or programs that he's pushed. So he's really going to sink or swim on people's views of Donald Trump and what Republicans have been doing in D.C.
Yeah, and that built-in advantage that Republicans have in Ohio lately, that the R next to his name will carry a lot of weight come November, regardless of how people feel about him individually. Let's get to this 9th Congressional District up in your neck of the woods. I want to set this up a little bit first. Republicans of the State House have been drawing and redrawing this district to oust longtime Democratic Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur. 2 years ago, she almost lost, beating Derek Merrin by just more than 2,000 votes. So Republicans last year made the district even redder, and the GOP candidates lined up to take her on. Derek Merrin was back. He was joined by State Rep Josh Williams, and a relatively late entrant into the race was former ICE Deputy Director Madison Sheehan. There were two other candidates as well on the ballot. In the end, it really was not that close. Merrin won 44% of the vote, 19 points better than Williams, and Sheehan was a pretty distant third. Let's go back to the campaign, Sam. What was the campaign like, especially the last few months? It was pretty spirited up there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was definitely some opposition research going on. I mean, the real battle, when you've got a district that's Republican plus 10, the battle's going to be in the primary. I think that all those candidates knew the stakes. And if they are able to defeat Kaptur, they could be sitting in Congress for, well, the next 40 years, you know, if the district remains a Republican plus 10 district. So the stakes were really high for them. You know, people are term limited. They have fewer options in terms of staying in the state legislature.
Derek Merrin had an advantage. He ran before, ran well 2 years ago, almost beat Marcy Kaptur, who's very popular. There were two other candidates. Josh Williams, he filed bill after bill after bill at the State House, cracking down on immigration, diversity and inclusion programs, LGBTQ rights. A lot of people were watching him saying he's got a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was going to be closer. I mean, Josh Williams never saw a culture war issue he didn't want to jump on, but that got him a lot of press. I mean, he's got high name recognition in the state and certainly up here in the district. The district boundaries may not be that advantageous to Josh Williams. His base is really kind of in suburban Toledo and things like that. And so I don't know if people know him as well in some other parts of the district or respond as well to what he's doing. Whereas, you know, Derek Merrin had high name recognition across the district since he was the candidate 2 years ago.
Yeah. Now, the wild card was this woman, Madison Sheehan. She is the former deputy ICE director. She came into the race late. We don't see the Toledo TV stations down here, obviously in Columbus, but Northwest Ohio, they see them. She was all over TV in April, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was definitely some money coming in that she was able to be on the air. She ran really strong in kind of the, you know, close to her home and then, you know, dropped off as she got further away from that. There's definitely, a sizable chunk of the Republican primary electorate who still very much supports ICE and President Trump's immigration policies. And she was the candidate that really leaned in on those issues.
I wonder if she would have done better had things not gone so poorly in Minnesota with the two deaths and the firing or the resignation of Kristi Noem and the shakeup in the immigration enforcement effort. I wonder if she would have done better. She may not have left ICE if things were going better, of course, but I wonder if she would have done better if immigration had not turned against Donald Trump to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, Kristi Noem's persona non grata in the Republican Party right now after she got, you know, defenestrated by Trump. And so I don't think that was doing her any favors. You could imagine, yeah, a different set of circumstances where she would run stronger. I could easily see her have gotten the nomination 2 or 4 years ago in the 9th district for the Republicans, but I'm not sure she was going to be a strong general election candidate for them. That ICE association, Kristi Noem and everything else would have really dragged her down in November.
Did Williams and Sheehan split the vote, the anti-establishment vote, the sort of far right vote, do you think?
That's a really good question. You know, Williams has been elected in office, you know, for a number of years. He's a more conventional politician with a politician's resume. So it seems to me like they would appeal to different segments. But I think Marin, you had to see Marin as the establishment candidate here because he had been the candidate 2 years ago and almost won. And so everybody was running against him. And in that way, maybe they split the vote. But that's not to say that if Sheehan was not in the race, that Josh Williams would have been able to win. I think Marin would have gotten some of those votes, too.
So the day after the primary, Marcy Kaptur had to have been rooting for either Williams or Sheehan.
And those would have been easier general election races for her, yeah.
And Republicans have to be breathing a little easier because they've really targeted this district. You know, the president has, this is one of the districts they're hoping to flip to sort of to offset this blue wave should it occur in November. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Republicans are going to be in a lot of trouble in November if they're losing R plus 10 districts like Ohio 9. That would be a historical kind of wipeout. They're going to focus on this a lot. We'll see a lot of outside money, I think, coming in from the campaign committees. Marcy Kaptur is pretty well funded, right? I mean, one of the advantages of being a 40-year incumbent is you have a broad fundraising network and know a lot of people. So it's not like she's going to fall way behind, but I would expect, you know, the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee to pour a ton of money into the race if the polling shows it as close.
Yeah, this is an R plus 10 on paper, but Marcy Kaptur is the person they have to beat. And she remains very popular. She won the last 2 years ago, even though Donald Trump carried Ohio easily, granted, you know. So she's kind of like Sherrod Brown. There was some ticket splitters there.
Yeah. I mean, both of them, both Kaptur and Sherrod Brown in their last races ran about 7 points ahead of the Democratic ticket, right? So Kaptur was 7 points ahead of Harris. Seven is not 10, yes. But it gets you a lot of the way there. But this year, the dynamics of the midterm election with a very unpopular Republican president, that's going to pull down the Republican ticket across the state. You know, I would look at the 2018 midterms where Republicans did very well in Ohio in 2018, but they won by small margins, especially as compared to, say, 2024.
Yeah, that's when Mike DeWine was first elected. He beat Richard Cordray by, I think, 4 or 5 points. So that was an indication of how that was sort of the more natural Republican lean in the state, which has gotten a little bit wider over the past 8 or 10 years.
But yeah, and the thing about the district is it was R plus 10 during the 24 presidential election, but Donald Trump's not on the ballot in November. He's not going to be on the ballot in 28. And he turns out voters, a group of voters that don't always turn out. So, you know, maybe the real lean of Ohio 9 is more like R plus 7, not R plus 10. Maybe that's a Trump effect or a Trump bonus that they got. And all of this gerrymandering that's gone on around the country has been based on Trump's electorate. But that doesn't mean J.D. Vance or some other Republican candidate can bring in those same kinds of numbers.
Yeah. It worked in Indiana. At least five of the seven candidates that Trump backed in the state legislature there, the folks who did not go along with his redistricting request, they all lost. And so among the Republican base, Donald Trump still has a lot of sway, but does that carry over to the general? That's what we will see now that the primary is over.
Absolutely, because, you know, a midterm election is a referendum on the incumbent president. When it's a Democratic president, when it's a Republican president, you know, always. And so the question is, Trump's endorsement is gold in a Republican primary right now, but it may be an anchor in a general election. Be really interesting to see how many candidates bring Donald Trump to town to campaign for them. That's a real indicator of whether people think that endorsement is going to help them or not.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Vivek Ramaswamy shares a stage with Donald Trump. It'll help with the base, and he might need some help with the base, but it's not going to help, perhaps, among statewide independents and Democrats. Anyway, real quick, the role of the Libertarian up in this 9th district, Tom Pruss, got 15,000 votes 2 years ago. As we said, Marcy Kaptur won by about 2,400. That certainly helped Marcy Kaptur, assuming that the Libertarians tend to be a little bit more on the conservative side. The Libertarian this year is Matthew Althaus. He got 436 votes in Tuesday's primary. What role will the Libertarian play in this race between Marcy Kaptur and Derek Marin?
Well, you know, I mean, the Libertarians have their own policy agenda and everything else. I don't want to make light of them, but they don't win a lot of elections, right? But they certainly can be a protest vote or a spoiler. Let's say you're a Republican voter, you're fed up with Donald Trump, you want to send that signal. You say, I'm not voting for Derek Marin because he's a Republican, but I'm certainly not voting for Marcy Kaptur, the Democrat. So you gravitate towards the Libertarian. That's an easy landing spot if you're a conservative voter who doesn't like the way things are going and you want to try to signal people in your own party.
Any reports of mischief? Oh, I hate to use that word, mischief, where Marcy Kaptur kind of secretly supports the Libertarian, and political insiders always kind of are looking for that and looking for to see if, you know, the people are trying to help the spoiler to help their own case.
That certainly happens, right? I mean, I think both parties do that. It's, you know, bare knuckles politics. You know, you would expect it, but it can really backfire too. You know, have to be careful what you wish for sometimes. And so, you know, I mean, Libertarians can draw some of her voters as well. I mean, yeah. One of the disadvantages of being in office for over 40 years is, you know, people get tired of you and maybe they want to change, but they don't want to change to the Republicans. So
It can cut both ways. I think Ross Perot cut both ways to some degree way back in the 90s and stuff like that.
We're still arguing about Ross Perot's effects on that race.
I know. We'll never settle that one. Anyway, we will have you back as this race develops, because this is probably the key congressional race in the state of Ohio. Cincinnati, I know, is Greg Landsman's district will be competitive and may flip as well. But I think this is the one to watch in Ohio. And Sam Nelson, University of Toledo political science professor, will have you back. And we thank you for joining us this week on Snollygoster.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll be right back.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
Welcome back to Snollygoster. A reminder and a request, if you like what you hear, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever platform you are using. And don't forget to tap that follow button so you can get every episode as they drop. Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past week. This week was a tough one for Melanie Lenihan of Delaware County, just north of Columbus. We've talked about her case before. She sat on the Delaware County Board of Elections. She was a member of the Republican State Committee. But then a fellow Delaware County Republican accused Lenihan of not living in Ohio, but in South Carolina. While Lenihan sold her Powell home north of Columbus last year and travels a lot for work and owns properties in South Carolina, she maintained that she still lives in Delaware County. She maintains to this day that she lives in Delaware County. She registered to vote at the address of a friend. And eventually, the friend transferred partial ownership of that home to Lenihan for free. The controversy bounced around the court and Delaware County Board of Elections over the past few months. Lots of drama. Well, this week, the Ohio Supreme Court put an end to it. The court ruled 7-0 that Lenihan no longer lives in Ohio, meaning she could be removed from the voter rolls and she could not run for her seat on the Republican Central Committee. And because she is not a registered voter, she cannot sit on the Delaware County Board of Elections. Such drama, such complicated drama. To think that she nearly beat Troy Balderson in the 2018 primaries for Congress. But for getting every member of the Ohio Supreme Court to agree on a controversial political issue, Melanie Lenihan gets our Snollygoster of the Week award. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster. We are a part of the NPR network. For our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineer, Dalton Jones, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.